Hello everyone, and welcome to what I'm sure will be a great evening. And for those of you who don't know me, my name's Maria Zenon and I lead the Alumni Relations Programme at the University of Law. Today we're delighted to be hosting our first in-person event for alumni since the pandemic. So may I say how thrilled I am to be here and surrounded by so many new and familiar faces in this wonderful location in the heart of legal London. It's been my pleasure to have spent the best part of last year working closely with a dynamic and a dedicated team of alumni to form the University of Law London Alumni Network. The network has been set up by this inspirational team who are here tonight with the mission to strengthen bonds of fellowship and collaboration among its members. So it's with great pride and excitement that I stand here tonight, and I would like to thank you all for joining us to celebrate the launch of the network. We settled upon London as our first UK group because the vast majority of alumni, by far, are based in London, so it made sense for us to start here. That's not to say, of course, that we would encourage and support more regional groups in the UK. So if this is something that interests you, please feel free to reach out to me anytime, where we'll all gather. So I'd now like to introduce you to Rebecca Sanrecki. Rebecca is co-chair of the London Alumni Network. She'll say a few words and lead us into the main event. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria, and thank you for being the inspiration behind the genesis of ULawLAN. We really hope this network empowers and enriches the lives of all who join. So if any of you haven't already filled out your registration form when you subscribe to tonight's event, if you fancy doing so, there are some hard copy registration forms at the back, or you can also join online. But I just wanted to share with you that I think everybody here today has been very blessed to have had the opportunity of legal training, which has opened doorways for so many of us into so many different brave new worlds where we've all had the opportunity to have a real and positive impact on the world around us. And on the note of our legal journeys or odyssey, where better to begin than here in the very heart of the legal profession in discussion with Lubna Suja, the incoming president of the Law Society. We're also very grateful this evening to welcome Professor Crisp, who has been such an integral part of the legal education expansion of opportunity, both domestically within the jurisdiction of the UK and also abroad in so many international domains. Professor Peter Crisp is the current Deputy Vice-Chancellor of Law at the University of Law and has also served both as Dean and CEO of the BPP Law School. Peter originally studied philosophy and also is very committed to pro bono work as the chairman of a charity called Support Through Court. And on that note, I'm going to hand over to Peter, who will mention more of his endeavours. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that introduction, Rebecca, and also to Maria for your work in organising this evening. And a huge thank you to Lubna for joining us this evening. A very warm welcome to you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
If we go back into the mists of time, 30 years, it's been 30 years, I think, is it this December, that you will have qualified as a solicitor, so your admission as a solicitor. So perhaps just go back into, you know, why did you become a lawyer? A family of lawyers, or are you the first in your family to be a lawyer?
No, I'm not from a family of lawyers at all. I was actually the first lawyer in the family. I'm originally from Bradford, and I went to a state school. And when I was growing up, I didn't know any lawyers. In those days, I mean, this will probably be a surprise to some of your audience, but we used to have three channels on the television, so there weren't even many dramas or anything like that. You know, we didn't have legal dramas. I didn't know any lawyers. I didn't have any legal role models. And quite honestly, I didn't think that law was something that somebody like me would be able to go into. It was just one of those things that you thought, no, I can't be a lawyer. That's not something I can ever achieve. So that was while I was at school. And then when I was doing my exams, I managed to do quite well in my A-levels, better than my teachers had predicted. And it was at that point that a friend suggested that, why don't you look at law? Because I was actually going to do English. My interest was actually in English, probably because I had a fantastic English teacher. And often it's our teachers that inspire us. And I also had a couple of cousins who were journalists at the BBC. And I thought that was a very glamorous job, being a journalist at the BBC. It was all. So that was what, you know, my thinking was I'd quite like it's going to what do you see? You see somebody you can relate to, and you think, "Well, I could do that." But I actually got a place to do English at university. But then, because I did quite well in my A levels, and somebody suggested, "You know, why don't you do a law degree? You could still go into journalism. It will still open various options for you."
It could be Lubna reporting from the Palace of Westminster this evening, and he's still Prime Minister. No, he isn't.
if that changes, do let us know during the course of the evening. Definitely. Yeah.
Well, I'm not encouraging anybody to be on their phones, by the way. So it wasn't journalism, it was law. So during the law degree, was there a turning point where you suddenly thought, this is what I want to do? Or?
Well, when I started the law degree, that was the first time I really found out what law was all about. And I was absolutely fascinated that, you know, there are cases here and these cases decide what happens to people. And, you know, reading about law and legislation and the framework that it puts around our legal system, found it really, really fascinating, really interesting. And, you know, there's a part of you that always has that kind of, what can I do to help people that are vulnerable, that are less able to help themselves? And law is a perfect fit for that, really. You can see where you can fit in and help other people make their lives better in some way. So I really enjoyed it. And once I got onto the law degree, it was then kind of you're kind of on the track.
Yes.
And then it's kind of, okay, what do you want to do? Do you want to be a solicitor? Do you want to be a barrister? Where are you going to go? You know,
Did you get good sort of careers advice, employability advice when you were at university?
No. We worked it out for ourselves. It was, talking to other students on the course. I think we probably did get some advice around, if you want to apply to become a solicitor, you need to do. In those days, it was the solicitor's finals exams. That's how old
LSF.
I am. LSF, that's how old I am, unfortunately. So it was either that or going to the bar.
Yeah.
And the bar never appealed to me. I mean, I thought law wasn't for me, bar definitely wasn't for me, you know. So, yes, I wanted to work with clients. I like the day-to-day interaction that you get with clients. So, yeah, that was the route that I decided to take.
So you applied for sort of, was it article clerkship in those days?
It was articles, So I did my solicitor's finals exams at the College of Law, just off Chancery Lane. And actually I did my degree in Red Lion Square. It was, in those days it was the Polytechnic of Central London.
Now the University of
Westminster. Westminster.
Yeah.
But I was literally up the road, so I started just near Holborn Station, came down to Chancery Lane Station, and 30 years later...
Full circle?
I'm in the building,
And about to become President of the Law Society of England and Wales.
So this was very much my turf as a student.
Yes. Yeah. So you were applying for article clerkships. I mean, what was the process like in those days?
Really difficult, really, really difficult. I sent off well over 100 applications.
100.
Yeah. And in those days, there was no real structure to getting articles. You literally put together a CV and sent a cover letter, and off it went to as many places as you could send it. And then if you were lucky, somebody might reply to you. I got a few rejections. I got a lot of just complete, no reply whatsoever. So, you're sending off all these applications, nothing comes back. And then I was lucky enough to get one interview. And that one interview was with Fladgate Fielder, who were just off Oxford Street, and they offered me articles. So it was fantastic that, the one foot in the door that I managed to get for an interview led to me getting articles.
How many trainees or article clerks?
Three of us.
And were you the only woman?
I was the only woman. I was the only Asian. I mean, there were only three of us. The other two were both guys.
So what was the experience like, 30 years ago doing, what we now call the training contract? What was it like? What stories can you tell us?
Oh, goodness, now you're asking me. I mean, actually, one of the things that I remember from that time, and this isn't specific to my firm, and it's actually not a nice story, but unfortunately it sticks with me, And I was doing training, and I don't drink. I don't drink alcohol, so I'm not used to drink. At that time, I wasn't used to drinks receptions. I wasn't used to, you know, going doing networking. I wasn't used to going to bars or pubs. In fact, I didn't do it, to be quite honest with you. But I remember one time I was at a networking reception where everybody was sort of drinking alcohol and things. And we were in a group of people and a partner from another firm in the area said to me at the time, he said, gosh, your hands are really black, aren't they? And I remember that. I remember that really, really well, because as a trainee solicitor, I didn't know how to deal with that. I didn't know how to handle it. And I was really, really embarrassed by it. And at that time, there were very, very, very few, solicitors that were from an Asian or black or ethnic minority ethnic background. In fact, now I know, since I've become DVP, I didn't know it at the time, but in 1990, when I was starting my training contract, there were only 709 solicitors who were either black, Asian, or minority ethnic throughout the whole of England and Wales.
Tiny number.
Tiny, tiny number. And I didn't see anybody that looked like me when I was doing it. So, you know, you're already conscious. You want to fit in. You know, you're doing your articles. You want to be taken seriously. You want to fit in. And it's really hard when somebody makes a comment about your, you know, that makes you feel different.
Yes.
And it was difficult to know how to handle that.
Did you have any allies within the firm?
No, not really. Not really. I wouldn't have said so. Nobody said anything when that comment was made. They all kind of looked a bit uncomfortable, but nobody said anything. I just wanted to...
And there were no networks you could join?
Shrink
or...
into the ground. Well, at that time, there used to be the... they're now the Junior Lawyers Division, but back then, I think they were called the Trainee Solicitors Group, and I joined them after a while. Not straight away. It took me a while to find out about them, but I joined them, and they were fantastic. It was great to be with your peers and chat to other people and share experiences. But again, they were all predominantly... They weren't black or Asian. I was the one that kind of...
Well, probably white, middle class, and predominantly male as well.
Very much so, very much so.
Well, there's a famous... we were chatting earlier, and one of my former students, Donna Dennis-Smith, set up this wonderful campaign called The First 100 Years, which is about the first 100 years of women in the legal profession, particularly the solicitors' profession. And there's a most extraordinary photograph of the partners' dinner at Herbert Smith in 1980. In the middle... there's the one woman partner, and then there's 100 male partners standing around her. I mean, it's quite a stark photograph.
I think they were quite progressive, actually, because I remember thinking back, there were two female partners there.
Yes, yeah.
Which actually, at that time, was quite progressive. Yeah. The rest of them were all male and white, but they did have
and from a limited number of universities and backgrounds.
So you
qualified, and which department did you qualify into? Which area of law did you practice?
So I did my articles in London, and then I actually went back to Bradford, which is where I'm from originally, and I started working with a high street firm there and litigation, because I just love going to court.
Loved it.
I really enjoyed. I enjoyed going to court. I enjoyed the. It was exciting, you know. It was. You felt like you were a proper lawyer. No disrespect to anybody that doesn't do litigation, but you know, I enjoyed that.
Yes.
The going into court, the you know making submissions, the advocacy that we had to do. I liked that. Yeah.
Well, of course. I mean, obviously, a milestone for you in December, but there's an even bigger milestone for Carrie Morrison, who, of course, was the first woman to be admitted as a solicitor in England and Wales, and it'll be 100 years,
18th of December. Yeah, 100 years, yeah.
And we've just unveiled a mosaic plaque to Carrie Morrison, actually in this building, I think, earlier this week, wasn't it?
Yes, it was yesterday, and the plaque is, it's actually made of, I think there's actually 100 photographs of women solicitors making up the picture of, and it's actually in the Carrie Morrison room just down the corridor here.
Okay, so if you get a chance, perhaps at the end of the evening, we can all pop down and have admire that. But I mean, that's an extraordinary milestone because there had to be a parliamentary act. It's the Sex Disqualification Removal Act 1919, which actually empowered her to become a solicitor. And that paved the way, obviously, for the entry of women into the profession for the first time. I won't ask you what's changed in the last 100 years, but what do you think has changed positively over the last 30 years?
Well, now we are, the profession is 62% women, which is fantastic. I mean, way back when I joined it, it was not at all anything. I mean, I don't know what the statistics were, quite frankly. I don't know what the statistics were back then, but there were not many women around. Now we're 62%, which is brilliant. But the flip side of it is also that they're not reaching senior levels in the same numbers. So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done to address that, to make sure that, you know, women are progressing to partnership level or you know, more senior positions within organisations.
What do you think can be done to do that? I mean, what sort of practical things could what changes would you recommend firms
to
do?
We give lots of advice. If Law Society, we try to provide lots of advice and guidance, you know. Unconscious bias is a big issue, training around unconscious bias. You know, one of the issues I think around women is this perception that, you know, they won't stay with the firm, they've got more caring responsibilities, they're not going to have the same commitment. And that's not true at all, but firms do need to think about how they can accommodate, because quite often women do have more caring responsibilities, and it's about thinking, you know, how do we accommodate that? And I think hybrid working, which has come out of the pandemic, has very much helped to progress that, for men and women, actually, not just women, because I think a lot of men also now want more quality time with families. Yeah. So that's been really positive, flexible working.
Yeah, no, super. So October this year, you become president of the Law Society.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And you will be the first Asian president of the Society. I know you've got a strong interest in ethics in particular. Are you going to pick up on the theme of ethics in your presidential year?
Yes, I hope to. I mean, my background is, so I'm now dealing quite a lot in professional regulation and disciplinary work. I'm a mediator, but I also chair a number of disciplinary panels for various professional regulators. And I've worked at the Solicitors Disciplinary Tribunal. I worked there for many, many years. So I have a real interest in standards, ethics, regulation. And I think ethics is something that is of real interest because it applies to so many different aspects of the work that a solicitor might do. You know, it can come. I mean, we do admission ceremonies here, and one of the pieces of advice that I tend to give to newly qualified solicitors is, you know, if you are at work and you make a mistake or you do something wrong, for God's sake, don't cover it up. Go and talk to somebody. Because a lot of solicitors coming in, they don't, you know, they're newly qualified, they're a little bit frightened, they don't want to put their profession on the line, they don't want to let their boss know, God, I've messed something up. But it's really, really important that they do come clean and not have that dilemma of, what do I do? Should I tell someone? Is my job going to be on the line? What am I going to do? You know, we also have, you know, ethics comes into nowadays, and one of the things that's changed since I qualified, there are 25% of our profession now work in-house. And when I was coming into the profession, you know, in-house didn't even exist. Nobody told me, you know, you can go and work in an organisation that's not a law firm. I didn't know you could go and work in local authority, local government. It just wasn't, you know, wasn't an option. But now we have 25% of our profession are in-house. And, you know, the question of ethics also for in-house lawyers is really quite important because they can find themselves in a situation where they may be advising their, you know, directors, whoever it is they work with on a particular issue. And the directors may say, well, we're not going to listen to that. We're going to do this because that's good for the business and that's what we want to do. And that may not necessarily comply with the lawyer's own regulatory obligations, and then they've got a dilemma. What do I do? You know, do I pull the plug? Do I put my foot down? How do I deal with it? So I think there's a piece of work to be done around, you know, discussions around this.
What role do you think does the Law Society specifically? Because obviously it's very obvious to say what role the SRA as the regulator has.
Yeah.
But what role do you think specifically the Law Society can play in this in terms of acting as a resource or a support for its members?
We know there's a code of conduct. We know that the SRA sets the standards. And I think for us, it's about making sure that where solicitors need guidance on what's a grey area, what should I do in this situation, they've got somewhere to turn to. We have a practice advice line, which any solicitor can call, either anonymously or, and they will be given advice on any issue that they might find, they're struggling with and they want some advice and guidance on. So we can help with that.
Wonderful. I thought we'd now turn to sort of access to justice, because I know that's, again, that's something that's close to your heart and indeed close to mine, as we'll talk about in a moment. We've seen barristers going on strike with the decimation of criminal legal aid. I mean, that's a rather big question, but what hope is there for a criminal justice system which appears to be, broken in many ways and struggling, really struggling?
It is very much broken at the moment. I mean, we have the number of firms that are doing criminal legal aid work now have halved in the last 15 years.
Wow.
So about 15 years ago, there were well over 2,000 firms that were doing criminal legal aid. Now we're just over 1,000. And just recently, the Law Society did a survey with our junior, under 35, lawyers that were under 35. And 81% of those lawyers said they would not even contemplate getting involved in criminal legal aid because the rates of pay are so low. I mean, they are below minimum wage. And we had a report recently. Sir Christopher Bellamy did an independent review into legal aid. And his recommendation was that the government needed to 15% funding needed to go into the criminal legal aid system and in pay. And we've only got 9% so far, although I think last week the government announced that that's going to start in September. And it's just not enough. Lawyers just can't get by on that. So it is a problem, because if you're not getting solicitors coming in to do criminal legal aid, they're not going to go through the system, they're not going to become judges. The average age of a criminal legal aid lawyer now is over 50, which is not good. It's not good for the profession.
I mean, those stats are extremely worrying, aren't
they?
Yeah. Because, I mean, although, most of the one hopes has very little encounter with, the criminal justice system, nonetheless, it's a fundamental importance to us as a society.
It is.
And if that's not functioning properly, and if lawyers are not willing to go into it, then that really is indicative of a broken society.
Yes.
Because I was going to move on, really, to something that's very close to my own heart, and Rebecca mentioned it, in her kind words of introduction. I've been involved with litigants in person for the last 8 years as a trustee and recently as chairman of Support Through Court. We used to be known as the PSU, the Personal Support Unit. We're now Support Through Court. And what my charity does is to support litigants in person in the civil and family courts. We don't offer legal advice, but we offer the sort of practical, emotional support that litigants in person need, so filling in forms, helping them with the paperwork, sitting with them in court, helping to marshal their thoughts and so on. And when I do a presentation to my students about the charity, and I do a graph of the demand for our services from, we founded in 2001, 2013, it's like that. 2013, after that, it goes up like that, more or less. And, of course, LASPO has absolutely, devastated the civil side as well, particularly for family. And there's some truly shocking, cases out there where people, for example, there was a famous case where there was a non-consensual adoption. And so the state is proposing to take, the child away from the parents for all time, but there's no legal aid available for them to defend
right.
it. And I just think, what are your thoughts on, can we have, a society of access to justice if there's no access to the profession, no access to lawyers?
To lawyers, yeah. We know from members that they are reporting an increase in the number of litigants in person that are appearing in court. And that is a problem, because they take up more court time. they need more expense. It's interesting because I was speaking to a judge literally last week who said that he will often get cases where a litigant in person will attend, and they will literally have printed pages and pages and pages and pages off the internet, and they'll produce a little bundle of, you know, 100 pages or whatever that they've just, and say, that's my case. That's what my case is. That's what I'm relying on. This is what my case is about. It's not a good way of, you know, and sometimes, you know, it's, Google is a great thing, but you yeah. will know.
Yes, indeed.
You know, a little bit of knowledge is sometimes a lot more dangerous than no knowledge at all. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty we've got is people just can't get funding to get proper legal advice anymore. I remember when I was at the early stage of my career, we used to have the Green Form at that time where you could get, you know, legal advice. And that was so valuable because, you know, somebody could come in the door and you could give them advice. And, you know, you could, sometimes they didn't even need a lawyer long term. It was just giving them a bit of information or a bit of advice to set them on, you know, with whatever the problem was. But there's none of that anymore. And that impacts not only on time in courts, but it impacts on cost. Yeah. It impacts on whether they feel that they're getting a fair hearing yeah. as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that last point is incredibly important because we always say with a charity, you know, it's not a question whether our clients win or lose, it's that they leave feeling that they had a fair hearing, yes, and that, you know, even though they didn't win, they had their day in court and they were listened to yeah. with dignity, and they've been able to engage with the civil justice system with dignity. And I think that's a huge problem in this country, that, you know, we're just not valuing that as a society.
Yeah. And the earlier they get legal advice, I mean, this is the other thing, the earlier you get legal advice, the more likely you're not going to end up
in court.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very, very, very serious problem. I thought we'd just sort of reflect now over the last couple of years, because as Maria said in her introduction, this is our first in-person event, as we now call them, in-person event for the last 2 years. And I just thought it might be useful just to reflect on what has been the impact, perhaps, of the pandemic, of COVID, on the profession. I mean, you hinted about it earlier, about some of the changes, but what do you think of the sort of the positives and the negatives of the pandemic on the legal profession?
Yeah, I mean, I think the positives are, I mean, certainly the use of technology just kind of, you know, progressed at the speed of lightning, quite frankly, in March 2020. You know, who would have thought we would be doing everything online? You know, we've had hearings online, we've had meetings online, we've gone to Zoom, we've gone to Teams. You know, that was just not even feasible back then. It wasn't something that we thought would happen so rapidly. So that's been really good, because that has obviously impacted on work-life balance. And it's really, you know, it's helped to some kind of hearings and meetings you can deal with online quite easily. Hybrid working has also become much, much more acceptable. I mean, pre-pandemic, most people were 9 to 5. Most people were, working a regular week, whereas now they're still probably doing 9 to 5 or whatever else they're doing, but they can mix and match it with going into the office and working from home. So I think that's been positive, a positive that's come out of the pandemic. Negative-wise, we have this issue of, you know, when people started working from home, you know, you didn't want to be, you didn't want to be living at work, basically. You just, you know, your home was turning into your work, and that was not good if you weren't able to switch off. So it was, you know, you had to, or employers had to make sure that people were not working long hours. And I think, you know, it has led to a mental health issues, which, on a positive, it's better to talk about them now. It's more acceptable to talk about them now, whereas it wasn't before.
No, I mean, I think that's absolutely right, and that also mirrors our experience at the University of Law with our students who, you know, obviously, for a lot of the pandemic, we had to teach online because we weren't able to teach in person. But certainly, we saw a lot of mental health issues yeah. with students, who were some of whom were really suffering and feeling isolated.
Yeah.
And I think it has been a very challenging time. On the other hand, as I was saying to students the other day on a webinar, you know, it is also an opportunity for you to say, during the pandemic, it was tough, but this is how I developed, and this is how I sort
yes,
of, you know,
yeah,
grew as a person, and so on. But I think we've all changed a lot, haven't we?
Well, we did have issues also younger junior members yep. and trainees around supervision and around, because, you know, you can't replace being in the office and watching how other people work and learning from watching them. That was really difficult to do when we went online. And even now, for those people that are doing a lot of hybrid working, there's still a challenge as to how do we supervise properly? How do we make sure they're getting proper training? How do we make sure they're learning? It was interesting because I was speaking to a young solicitor a few weeks ago, and she actually said, I like going into the office because I've realised that when I'm in the office and other younger solicitors or trainees are not in the office, because I'm there, other members of staff who are working in the office, they see me, they recognise me, get to know me, and they're more likely to say to me, oh, just come and help me with this, just come and help me with that, just come and do this with me, just come and do that. And then she said, it leads to me getting better quality work because I'm here and they know me and they've got to know me and they know how I'm working. So it's kind of, how do you address that for those people that are not in the office quite so regularly?
It's a difficult balance because for me, it's a sort of the stupid test and question test is, you know, we've all got stupid questions. Like, this is a really stupid question, Lumda, but how do I do this?
Yeah.
And how do you do that online?
Well, there's because... no such thing as a stupid question. That's what I always say, it's difficult.
It is very, very difficult, very challenging, yes. But I think the positives in the end will outweigh the negatives myself.
I hope so, absolutely. I mean, certainly now I think we're finding people are starting to settle into a routine of, so many days in the office, so many days at work.
So as vice president, as president, what will your hybrid be, do you think?
Oh, well, I don't know. We'll have to see how things are evolving as they go. I personally do like to meet people in person. I don't mind doing online meetings, but I don't think you can replace being in person. You don't form the same rapport online. You can't read body language as well online. I prefer personally in person, but you know, we'll go with the flow.
And you were saying when we were talking beforehand that, you know, it's actually a very full-on role, isn't it, as president?
It is.
So
it is.
You know, not every minute of the day, but virtually.
Yes, very much
of the working
so.
Day, and often into the evening, I suspect as
very
well.
Very much so.
And I suspect now we are, you know, we're sort of more or less out of the pandemic, I hope.
Well, we say that the numbers were going up last week.
They were,
I think.
Well, yes.
Yeah. So yeah. I daren't hold my breath anymore. I'm just. Can't hope.
Yeah. Obviously, you've shared some of your experiences as an Asian woman of colour, you know, 30 years ago. And obviously, the profession is doing a huge amount around EDI, equality, diversity and inclusion, and also around, you know, widening access. How does the sort of Law Society have a role in promoting diversity within the profession? How do you see that?
We're doing a great deal. I mean, we have social mobility ambassadors, which I'm sure many of you will have seen. There are pictures of them in the corridor outside, and they tend to be solicitors who are from less privileged backgrounds, and they tell their stories. They talk to other students, trainees, to, you know, share their experiences and how they've managed to succeed in what they're doing. We have a diversity access scheme, which provides funding for students from less advantaged backgrounds. You've got me, you've got, you know, the current office holders.
Absolutely.
Who are really out there trying to be positive role models, trying to show that the face of our profession is changing, which it is. You know, we have a lot of materials on our website as well. We have tools for employers to use, so around recruitment techniques, retaining talent, progressing talent, you know, how to avoid bias. So we try to do a great deal to support members as much as we can.
I know that some people may find the next sort of question I'm going to ask sort of a little bit technical, but it's really around the changes that the SRA are making to how you qualify as a solicitor. Because obviously, in the last 30 years, you did the Law Society finals,
I did.
Clerkship.
Yeah.
I suspect most people in this room probably did a training contract, or a legal practice course, followed by a training contract. And of course, we now have a third sort of regime change, as it were. We're going to the solicitor's qualifying exam, the SQE, and then qualifying work experience, which will replace the current regime. I mean, I'll just, for those who don't live and breathe this as I do, obviously at the University of Law, I thought I'd just briefly explain what's happening. The SRA are changing the route to qualification, so the legal practice course is going to be phased out, and it's already started, so over the next few years, the legal practice course will disappear to be replaced by the solicitor's qualifying exam, the SQE, and that is a centrally set assessment, which is run by by Kaplan on behalf of the SRA, which means that everybody who qualifies in England and Wales as a solicitor will have done exactly the same set of assessments. SQE1 is the sort of the foundation of legal knowledge, which is being tested by multiple choice questions, and then you've got SQE2, which is the skills piece, and then they're changing the training contract into qualifying work experience. So we've got quite a radical change to the way people qualify. And I think, to say the least, it sparked a lot of conversations amongst practitioners about these changes. Does the Law Society have a particular view of these reforms, moving away from the current LPC route to these sort of centrally set assessments? Is it a good idea?
Well, the thinking behind the SQE was that it would allow access into the profession. Social mobility was one of the reasons why it was introduced. So that we absolutely support. Anything that allows, students who have the talent and the skills to become solicitors, we want them to be able to join the profession. That's really, really important. I think one of the things around the SQ at the moment, it's very, very early days. And we know that the results from the first set of exams have shown that actually black, Asian and minority ethnic students have not performed that well. And we want to understand why that is. We want to know, what can be done to address that. And at the moment, I don't think we've got those answers. The other issue also is that at the moment, there's no funding available. There's no for people that are doing SQE. So we are in discussions with the government to try and look at what can be done about that. Because that's really important. I mean, going back to when I came into the profession, I was very, very fortunate because at that time, local authority grants were available to help you pay for some of your, some of your fees and your living costs or whatever. And I know that if I hadn't got a grant, I would not have been able to afford to join the profession. My parents were working class parents. They couldn't afford to pay the kind of fees that you needed for university. And I certainly would not, I think, have been brave enough to have taken on the kind of loans that I think students do now, not knowing whether they're going to have a job at the end of it. I think that's, it takes real courage for people to do that, and I'm not sure I would have been able to do that. So I think, coming back to the SQE, there are still questions that need to be answered. If it achieves social mobility as it is supposed to do, of course we would support that, because we want to improve and widen access to the profession as much as we can.
Now, I mean, I think you're right, Lubna, it's very early days. We've only got, as you say, the first iteration of the results, and only a very small number of students have actually sat SQE so far. So I think the jury is out. But I think, the underperformance of certain groups, the protected characteristic groups, is actually quite worrying.
Yes.
And whether there's some inbuilt bias within the way that the SRA is assessing, either for multiple choice or whatever. I think they've commissioned the University of Exeter to look into
it. So
there's going to be a report, but probably 18 months away from that. So I think it is a big concern.
I think the other thing also is gathering data also depends on the number of people that are doing it and the number of firms that are willing to take that on. And because it's very, very early days, it probably will take a bit of time before we can.
Yeah, I mean, our apprentices have done very well, but it's very tiny numbers. The apprentices obviously are on a 5.5-year apprenticeship, and they do SQE as part of that program or that journey. And they've been highly successful. But it's very, very, again, it's very small numbers, and it's very, very early days. And I think it's once we start getting the volumes of students who start taking it, we'll actually start to understand whether this is, been a move in the right direction or perhaps something that needs a rethink. So
absolutely. Yeah.
I think what's really come across from our conversation is your sort of genuine enthusiasm for the profession, because your eyes sort of lit up when you talked about, I'm a litigator, I'm in court. There was a real vibrancy there, which is absolutely fantastic. So I think your personal experience as a solicitor has been pretty dynamic.
I've really enjoyed my career as a solicitor, I have to say. Over the years, I've kind of dealt with different areas of law, but I've always been a litigator at heart. And I've really, really enjoyed that. I have enjoyed that. But, I am quite, I'm proud to be a solicitor. I'm proud of our profession. And I hope that, you know, one of the things when I hopefully take office in October, I really want to promote our profession to the wider public. I want the public to understand what value solicitors bring to society and why it's important that we have solicitors. Why should you go and see a solicitor as opposed to, you know, an unregulated legal provider? We solicitors help communities to survive. We help businesses. We help individuals. The sad thing is that a lot of people, apart from buying a house or maybe writing a will, most people will not need to use a solicitor unless they're in trouble. And that's when they realise what the value is. And that's if they can afford it, because that goes back to the discussion around, you know, legal aid and access to lawyers. But those that do, they will see the value and they will see what a difference that can make to their lives. And I really want them I really want to promote that to the wider public. That, you know, our profession is synonymous with integrity. You know, we have a reputation, an international reputation. You know, other countries look to England and Wales to as leaders in you know, what does a good jurisdiction look like. So I'm really keen to promote all of that.
Yeah. So 30 years in the profession, I'm sure you've got some stories to tell, highs and lows. I mean, what's been the highlight of your career? I mean, obviously, about to become president of the Law Society.
That is the highlight. I mean, I think that has to be the highlight. You know, when I was elected deputy vice president, that was definitely a highlight. But actually, you know, when you think back through your career, you know, when I first got my training contract, my articles, that was a highlight at that time, because it was like, wow, I finally got, you know, that was a highlight. And then when I got a job, and then when I became partner. So you have, I think you have little highlights all along your career. They kind of lead you to the next step, to the next step. You focus on what's coming, work really hard, aim for where you, and then things will follow.
It's pretty clear you've enjoyed the journey, though, isn't it?
I very much have, yeah, very much so.
So those are sort of the highlights. If we were sort of to dig around and say, what were the sort of, you know, the sort of the lowlights, as it were?
That's a tough question to think about, really. One of the things which will probably, I suppose it's not really a low light, but it wasn't brilliant. So when I first qualified, the firm that I started working with, and this was not just that firm, this was kind of quite a normal thing to happen. Women were not allowed to wear trousers, which is just utterly ridiculous when you think about it now. But, you know, you were not allowed to wear trousers to work as a solicitor. And that was really kind of, but I changed that. I managed to persuade them to you know.
So you influenced them.
Yes, I did. I managed to change that. So that was a good thing. But, you know, coming into the profession, you know, you think, God, what century are we living at? What do you mean? What do you mean women can't wear trousers? Don't be ridiculous. But, you know, it was a traditional thing that, you know, women did not wear trousers.
Yeah, so stereotyping women, and, you know, as if it could affect the quality of the legal advice that you gave.
Yeah.
If you suddenly donned trousers.
Yeah. So it's good to see that. It was good to see that change.
It does seem very eccentric.
Yeah.
And it's good that we can laugh about it now,
actually.
Even though at the time it must have seemed utterly ridiculous.
Well, it was. It completely was. Completely was. Yeah.
I think we've got time for a few questions from the floor. Anybody like to ask Lubna anything? Yes, please, our first question.
Hi there, it's Tom.
Hi.
Really nice to hear all your stories and everything. It's really great. I just had a quick question about the whole legal aid and the criminal kind of law, and there's a sort of renegement in relation to the industry. Like 80% of people are just not getting involved. And it's just interesting to know whether... I know there's pro bono and things like that, but would you ever consider it or see any kind of ramifications, or whether you see any issues in relation to mandating kind of lawyers within the industry wholesale to allocate a portion of their time, you know, annually or as a one-off, so to speak, across the industry to actually work, you know, in criminal law for a bit, maybe take some time out for a month or whatever, you know, to actually help out the community as a sort of wholesale mandated thing across the industry? And has that been done, or, you know, do you see any issues in relation to actually doing that? So that's my question.
I mean, I think a lot of firms a lot of firms do pro bono work already, and they're very proud of the pro bono work, and rightly so. That, you know, it meets a need and it's very important. But I think it can't possibly replace criminal legal aid. You know, it's not an answer. It's not a solution. The solution is the money. The government needs to put more money into it. We can't rely on the, on the good intentions of firms to try and plug a gap that actually the government should be plugging, not firms. So it's great that they do it. We wouldn't say they shouldn't do it, but it's not the answer, not by a long shot, I think.
Question.
Hi, so my name's Kishan. I'm actually a former student and currently a visiting lecturer at the University of Law, so speaking from both perspectives for a moment. In respect to the SQE, and I know that we've got the nine... And I'm just going to tell two topics very quickly, but I'll touch on the SQE quickly. I know it's a nine-year transition period, but there's a view within the city, and I'm also a lawyer in Kirklands and Ellis, and it's a view in the city that there's going to be a two-tier system, one where students have gone through the SQE and get the period of recognised training, and those who still go through a training contract, and that could put students at a disadvantage. So how, in that nine-year period, where there'll be thousands of students going through that process, do we bridge that gap on the first point? Secondly, when it comes, and I ask you this in your role in disciplinary tribunals in particular, and what we talked about with legal aid and with litigants in person, there is a huge gap within disciplinary proceedings where individuals who are not union represented do suffer in disciplinary tribunals, which are civil, on a base of civil, you've got the civil liability in terms of balance probabilities. But for them, the implications are almost criminal in that career ending, life ending for many people. And how do you think we bridge again? Bridging the gap question, but how do you think we do that when it is such, it's never in the focus of anyone in the profession, and it's really good to see you're at the GPHC, for example, and have that role, and what more we can do about that? Thank you.
So okay. Two questions.
Yes, so let me take the second one first, because that's... So I think one of the things that we need to... You're absolutely right. We do, you do get a lot of people representing themselves when they're appearing before the Solicitors Disciplinary Tribunal. We do have the Solicitors Assistance Scheme who support solicitors and give them guidance and advice when they are appearing. A lot of solicitors are not aware that they can get insurance to cover them for disciplinary costs. And I think that's something that we need to raise more awareness of, that, you know, if you take out a policy, should you find yourself before the SRA or the SDT, that policy will help you with your legal costs. Many solicitors don't realise that until it's too late. You know, when they're in the situation, then they realise, oh, gosh, I wish I'd done something about this. So raising awareness of that is really, really important. What was the other question? The quality of training contracts. Yeah. So across the professions in terms of the disciplinary costs, a lot of the other professions actually have policies. They provide a union, so members can join a union and they will get their costs covered. They will be represented by somebody from that union and their costs will be covered. Slightly different for solicitors. We don't have that at the moment. Certainly something we need to look at, how we can improve the position for solicitors, and it is something that I will be looking at during my year as president and exploring with insurers and, you know, wider community to see what we can do about that. Coming back to the SQE and the LPC and quality of training, solicitors have got to qualifying work experience. That's going to come down to the quality of qualifying work experience, I think. Again, it's still early days because it's so new. We're still waiting to see how that's going to work and how it's going to come about. But if qualifying work experiences are, they provide the proper guidelines, and we can make sure that students that are going through qualifying work experience are getting good qualifying work experience, then there's no reason why they shouldn't be on a par of, there shouldn't be that tiered system, really.
I think the gentleman in the middle row here was next.
Hi there. My name is Jamin. You spoke earlier about ethics and the international standing of the Law Society and legal profession in the UK. Given what's happened over the last year or so, especially with politics, what do you think the Law Society can do to really re-establish us, not domestically, but internationally, as qualified and highly regarded lawyers?
I knew somebody was going to ask me something to do with what was going on. So, I mean, I think one of the things that I've really been keen on promoting, because, you know, the government has had this rhetoric and it has impacted on our members, but actually our members have been acting within the law. Whatever they're doing, the law allows them to do that, and they're acting in the best interests of their clients. So it's really important to stress that, you know, they are not doing anything that they should not be doing. They are doing what the law allows them to do. And, you know, our profession internationally is well regarded because we uphold the rule of law, because we follow the rule of law. You know, we have we do challenge the government. We have judicial review that's in place to allow us to challenge the government if we think that the government is behaving in a way that it shouldn't be behaving. And that's really highly regarded by the rest of the world. You know, I've spoken at events, international events, and it's really interesting how other jurisdictions listen really carefully to what we say, because they see us as a leader in the field. They see us as a global legal centre, and they look to us for guidance. They look to us to, you know, how do we solve with this situation? So I think it's about talking about it. It's about raising the profile. It's about, you know, solicitors, we have a code of conduct. We have to follow a code of conduct. We have standards that we have to comply with. We have an SRA that regulates us if we don't meet those standards. So, you know, there is a provision in place where, you know, if we're not doing what we should be doing, we can get called out for that. And it's really important to make sure that other jurisdictions are aware of that. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and we do. We have a very, very active international programme. We engage with many bars abroad. We engage with many law societies abroad. And we talk a great deal about how we promote access to justice, you know, how the rule of law is so important here, and what we do to make sure we uphold that. So I'll continue to do that work.
Rebecca, we've probably got time for just one more question.
Touched upon. One is vocational training element, which is changing, as we know, from the traditional training contract to the training element of the SQE. I believe there was an interim measure put in place by the SRA known as the equivalent means, which provided for the period of recognised training. And also, I think Peter himself has done a lot of work with vocational training in the city. So I suppose in relation to what you're saying about the interaction of the British legal system with international systems, is there anything for the British system to learn? Sorry, the third point that this question touches upon is access to the legal profession from different minority groups and unconscious bias that could potentially be present when training contracts are allocated. And would there be anything to be learned from the American system, which doesn't actually require the PRT, period of recognised training? And I suppose the other add-on to that question is whether or not the equivalent means and the SQE ultimately will make the period of recognised training more challenging than it was with the training contract, because it's a heavier burden in terms of providing the portfolio of work and all the exhibits. So would there be anything to be gained from following the American system, which just dispenses with that requirement?
I've got to be honest with you, I don't know a great deal about the American system. Certainly something I'll look into. So I don't know whether you know more about it than I do. Or...
Well, essentially, there's no qualifying work experience in the States. You do your JD, and then you can, in theory, practice. I say in theory because, in fact, what you do is you normally go into a law firm and you obviously, you know, are supervised, or there's some sort of structured approach to what you do. But you are a fee earner from day one of having completed. So there's no training contract, there's no qualifying work experience or anything like that.
that sounds a bit scary to me, actually. You know,
I think my view is... I think it's actually the jewel in the crown that we do have this supervised period of training. And the qualifying work experience is going to change things quite dramatically because people will be able to have a sort of more portfolio experience during the qualifying work experience. And in fact, at the University of Law, we're offering qualifying work experience 1 month guaranteed to our students to do the SQE with us. So I think there are advantages to it. But I think, you know, it's like an apprenticeship, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can learn and make mistakes on the job. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. And I mean, it also addresses the big problem that we were having with paralegals, that, you know, people were being employed as paralegals and it wasn't really helping them to progress their legal career. Whereas now, at least, you know, that it's giving some structure to that so that it will help them. But no, I'm afraid I can't comment on the American legal system, sorry.
I'm conscious that if I ask you any more questions, I will be keeping people from the drinks reception at the back of this splendid hall. I mean, what a journey. Bradford, Red Lion Square, Chancery Lane.
Back to Bradford. Yeah.
And then Chancery Lane again.
Birmingham in between.
Birmingham in between. Lubna, thank you so much for your time this evening. Huge appreciate it. And thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you.
Thank you.